A man walks into a restaurant on a foggy Sunday morning in Jefferson, Texas, January 21st, 1877. He orders two picnic lunches, chicken, bread, beer, pays without haggling, carries the baskets outside to where a young woman is waiting. She is striking, dark hair, gray eyes, and diamonds. Diamonds on her fingers, diamonds at her throat, diamonds catching what little light the fog allows. They walk together toward the footbridge, over Big Cypress Bayou. The wooden planks creak under their weight. The bayou below is dark and still. The fog takes them in pieces. First their legs, then their torsos, then the last glint of diamond light. They are walking toward the woods, toward a picnic. She will never cross that bridge again. 2 weeks later, a woman collecting firewood will find a body propped against a twisted oak tree, fully clothed, no jewelry, a single bullet hole in the left temple, and the remains of a picnic lunch scattered in the winter leaves beside her. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is season 40, 50 states, 50 forgotten crimes, 250 years of American history. Tonight, Texas and Pennsylvania. Two crimes from the Gilded Age. Two killers who destroyed the people closest to them. Two trials that asked the same question: is this person guilty? And arrived at opposite answers. In 1877, Texas, a rich man's son murdered a woman and bought his freedom with an army of lawyers. In 1888, Philadelphia, a destitute mother poisoned her family and walked to the gallows with no one to speak for her. The story of Diamond Bessie begins with a shoemaker's daughter from upstate New York and a jeweler's son from Cincinnati. Her real name was Annie Stone, and this is how she ended up on a foggy bridge in East Texas. Annie Stone was born around 1854 in the Syracuse area of upstate New York. Her father was a shoemaker on Factory Street, a name that tells you everything about the neighborhood. Leather and tanning solution, an honest trade, a small life. What drove her away from it, we do not know for certain. By most accounts, she was 15 when she left home with a man named Moore. Whether she was running towards something or away from it, the record does not say. We only know she took his name, and she never came back. As Bessie Moore, she built a life in the upper reaches of Gilded Age sex work, upscale establishments in Cincinnati, New Orleans, Hot Springs. These were not desperate corners. They were parlors that catered to wealthy men, and Bessie was exceptional even in that company. Intelligent, charming, beautiful, dark hair, gray eyes, fair skin, and diamonds. She accepted fine jewelry as payment and wore it everywhere. The nickname followed, Diamond Bessie. It was armor and advertisement, a shoemaker's daughter declaring her worth in the only currency the world would accept from her. Every room she entered, the diamonds said the same thing. I may be what you think I am, but I am not what you think I am worth. She met Abraham Rothschild in Hot Springs in 1875. His father, Meyer, was a prosperous Cincinnati jeweler, not the European banking dynasty, but wealthy enough. Abe was handsome. He was also an alcoholic, a gambler, and a man whose family's money let him get away with everything. They married on January 11, 1877, in Danville, Illinois. A reporter who saw them that day described Bessie as strikingly beautiful. 10 days later, she was dead.
January 19, 1877. The couple arrives in Jefferson by train. They register at the Brooks House Hotel as A. Monroe and wife, already hiding behind a false name. To understand what Jefferson was in 1877, you need to understand what it had just lost. 2 years earlier, this was the biggest river port in Texas. 75,000 bales of cotton shipped through its wharves every year. Then the Army Corps of Engineers destroyed the natural logjam that kept the water levels high, and the railroad went through Marshall instead. By the time Bessie arrived, Jefferson was a town in decline. Grand hotels struggling to fill rooms, a fading place. Into this walks a beautiful woman, dripping in diamonds, and a well-dressed man with money. The town noticed. Staff at the Brooks Hotel noticed something else. The maid, Jenny Smith, heard loud arguments behind the couple's door. Sounds of violence, crying. Sunday morning, January the 21st, Rothschild buys two picnic lunches at Henrique's. They cross the footbridge over Big Cypress Bayou. The fog takes them. That afternoon, Rothschild comes back alone, a different path. He tells hotel staff his wife is visiting friends. He is drinking heavily. Monday morning, he is seen at the Brooks house wearing two of Bessie's large diamond rings. He has stripped the diamonds from his dead wife and put them on his own fingers. Tuesday, he boards an eastbound train, carrying both his luggage and hers. He is gone. For 2 weeks, nobody looked for her. And then a woman gathering firewood in the East Texas woods found something that didn't belong there. February 5th, 1877, a woman named Sarah King, a black woman collecting firewood along the Marshall Road, finds a body in the woods. The danger of that moment should not be lost. This is East Texas, 1877, 1 year after federal troops withdrew from the state. Reconstruction is over. A black woman has just found the body of a dead white woman. The risk of being accused, of being blamed, of being the one who made the discovery in that place at that time, that must have been terrifying. The body of a well-dressed woman propped against a twisted oak tree, fully clothed, no signs of assault, no jewellery anywhere on her, a single gunshot wound to the left temple, and scattered around her, chicken bones, breadcrumbs in wrapping paper, a half-finished bottle of beer, the remains of a Sunday picnic 2 weeks old. Cold weather, snow and sleet had preserved her. The coroner ruled cause of death, gunshot wound to the head. Citizens of Jefferson took up a collection and buried the unknown woman at Oakwood Cemetery. They didn't know her name. They buried her anyway. Authorities connected the body to the couple at the Brooks house. A. Monroe was traced to the Capitol Hotel in Marshall, registered there under a different name. A. Rothschild and wife, Cincinnati. A warrant went out for Abraham Rothschild. In Cincinnati, Rothschild was coming apart. Paranoid, drinking, convinced he was being followed. He attempted suicide by shooting himself outside a saloon. But he succeeded only in blinding his right eye. He was arrested in the hospital. His family fought extradition. They lost. In March 1877, Abe Rothschild was transported to Texas in chains. The first trial came in December 1878 in Marshall, moved from Jefferson because everyone in that town already knew the story. What makes this significant is the scale of the defense. The Rothschild family fortune had assembled a legal army, up to 10 attorneys, led by U.S. Congressman David B. Culberson and his son Charles, who would one day become governor of Texas. These were not court-appointed lawyers. This was money deployed as a weapon. 3 weeks of testimony. The prosecution's case was, by every account, overwhelming. Governor Hubbard himself called it a crime without equal in the record of bloodshed. The jury convicted, death by hanging. The jury foreman drew a noose on the wall of the deliberation room and scrawled beneath it his verdict. But then the appeal. Defense attorneys found a technicality. The prosecutor had been present during the grand jury deliberations, which was improper under Texas law. Judge Clark overturned the conviction. A death sentence, gone. A second trial began in Jefferson in December 1880. A new indictment, new testimony. The defense brought forward a woman named Isabel Gowdy, who had helped prepare Bessie's body for burial. She claimed she saw Bessie alive in the company of a different man days after the murder. The testimony has been questioned for over a century. It has never been proven false. Rothschild did not testify. His lawyers did not need him to. They shredded the prosecution witness on cross-examination. December the 30th, 1880. The jury deliberated from 4 in the afternoon to 8 at night. 4 hours. The verdict? Not guilty. The best evidence? The governor's own prosecutors. And it was not enough. The Rothschild money won. Abraham Rothschild walked out of that court a free man. And what he did with that freedom tells you everything about what kind of man he really was.
After the acquittal, Rothschild went back to Cincinnati. He did not become a better man. He became a worse one. His documented post-acquittal life, posing as a wealthy businessman to acquire jewelry on credit. Aliases, jewel theft, forgery, mail fraud, bribing officers with counterfeit money. He served time in Missouri and at Huntsville Prison in Texas. A walking crime spree, wearing a patch over his blinded right eye. I'll be honest, this part of the story sat with me. He tried to kill himself outside a saloon and missed by an inch. Blinded one eye instead. He wore that wound for the rest of his life. Bessie couldn't know, walking across that bridge, that the man beside her would carry a bullet in his skull for decades and never once be punished for hers. Whether that blinded eye was a daily reminder of what he'd done, or just a daily inconvenience for a man who felt nothing at all, we don't know. I'm not sure it matters. For decades, Bessie's grave at Oakwood Cemetery was unmarked. The town had buried her. They had not named her. In the 1930s, a retired foundry worker named E.B. McDonald installed a tombstone at the grave one night. Nobody asked him to. He just did it. In the 1960s, a garden club built an iron fence and added a marble bench. Since 1955, Jefferson had staged an annual reenactment of the Diamond Bessie murder trial, a town that adopted a stranger and refused to let her be forgotten. And then there is this. It has never been confirmed, but the story has survived more than a century. In the 1890s, according to local tradition, an elderly man with a patch over his right eye visited Bessie's grave. He laid roses. He knelt in prayer. He gave the caretaker money for the upkeep. Then he left, and nobody saw him again. Whether it was Rothschild or not, whether it was guilt or grief, or just a story people told because they needed the world to contain some justice, the legend survives. The grave is tended. Her real name was Annie Stone. She was a shoemaker's daughter from upstate New York who wrapped herself in diamonds and walked through the world on her own terms until a man with money decided those terms were over. He killed her, and then his family's fortune killed justice. That is the thing about scales. They only balance when the weights are equal. They almost never are. A man killed a woman he was supposed to love, and his family's money turned a death sentence into a handshake with the courthouse door. That is the story of Diamond Bessie. But it's not the only story of Diamond Bessie, because 11 years later, and 1,000 miles northeast, in a cramped back building apartment in Philadelphia, a different kind of killer faced a different set of scales. No family fortune, no army of lawyers, no congressmen to argue on her behalf. Nothing except a box of rat poison and the terrible arithmetic of insurance policies. And when the scales weighed her life against her crimes, they did not tip toward mercy. This week's episode is brought to you by Guess Again, the new psychological thriller by Charlie Dunley, best-selling author of 20 Years Later, The Girl Who Was Taken, and Those Empty Eyes. If you spend as much time thinking about cold cases as I do, this one is going to grab you. Guess Again opens 10 years after 16-year-old Callie Jones vanishes from a small Wisconsin lake town. No body, no answers. Just a community still living inside the silence. Then on the 10th anniversary, a dying detective makes a confession that cracks the case wide open, pulling a former cop right back into the work he swore he'd left behind. I read it in 2 sittings. The pacing is patient, the setting is atmospheric, and the final stretch genuinely made me set the book down for a second. If you're into Riley Sager, Ashley Flowers, or Alex Finley, this one belongs at the top of your stack. Guess Again by Charlie Dunley. Out May 26th. Pick it up wherever you get your thrillers. All right, real quick. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they figured out how to combine THC with functional ingredients, create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Shane, S-H-A-N-E. They've found products for every vibe to help you sleep, get focused, feel happy and euphoric, even for better sex. I've been into their Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. After a long week digging through case files, my brain does not want to shut off. I pop one of these about 15 minutes before bed, and it's like someone finally hits the off switch. No grogginess the next morning either. Beyond gummies, Mood also has flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Everything ships discreetly right to your door. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned earlier, listeners get 20% off their first order with Shane, S-H-A-N-E. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches what you're looking for, and don't forget to use promo code Shane at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Try it today at Mood.com. It is late at night in Philadelphia. The year is 1888. In the rear apartment behind number 1227, Caldwater Street. The address tells you everything about the family that lives there. A woman sits at a table. She is 40 years old. Her husband is asleep in the next room. Her daughter, 9, and her son, 2, are curled together on their bed. The apartment is small enough that she can hear all 3 of them breathing. She has purchased something from the drugstore. A box. It costs very little. On the front, it says, Rough on Rats. Her name was Sarah Jane Whiteling. Within 67 days, everyone in that apartment except her will be dead. And the scales of justice will not hesitate, not for a single hour, about what to do with a poor woman who kills. John Whiteling, 38 years old, a streetcar conductor, then a factory worker. Two occupations that in 1888 Philadelphia meant long hours, low pay, and the kind of work that grinds a man down without ever making him known. He married Sarah Jane in March 1880, taking on both her and her infant daughter, Bertha, from a previous relationship. In 1886, they had a son together, William, called Willie. John was not a remarkable man, not wealthy, not famous. He was the kind of man who got up in the dark, went to work, came home tired, and did it again. Bertha, 9 years old, her biological father, Thomas Story, ran an oyster saloon and had left before she could remember. John Whiteling was the only father she knew. She collected things, pennies, pocketbooks, testing boundaries the way 9-year-olds do. Her mother would later call this sinful and wicked. Willie, 2 years old, just beginning to talk, just beginning to walk with confidence, born into a family that was already failing. The family at number 1227 Caldwater Street, the rear apartment. A back building, cramped, dark, poorly ventilated, converted from a workshop or a stable. The poverty was real. A factory worker in 1888 Philadelphia might earn $300 to $500 a year. The Whitelings were below even that. Sarah had taken out small insurance policies on all three of them. The kind of industrial life insurance that companies like John Hancock and Prudential marketed aggressively to their working poor. Burial money. A buffer against total ruin.
Sarah Jane Whiteling was born in 1848 in Germany. By most accounts, she was brought to America as an infant, and her mother died shortly after they arrived. The records suggest she was raised by a foster family in Iowa until she was 12. Her first husband, Tom Brown, died at Eastern State Penitentiary after a conviction for highway robbery, a life of abandonment, loss, and poverty from the very beginning. The weapon was cheap, rough on rats, arsenic trioxide with coal dust, manufactured by E.S. Wells of New Jersey, available at any drugstore, no questions asked. Nearly tasteless, and its symptoms? Vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal cramps, look exactly like natural illness. A medical journal of the period called it a needlessly cruel minister of the angel of death. March 20, 1888, John Whiteling dies after days of vomiting and abdominal pain. The attending physician, Dr. G.W. Smith, diagnoses inflammation of the bowels. Sarah collects $230 in insurance, roughly half a year of factory wages. April the 25th, 1888, Bertha dies, same doctor, same failure to detect. Diagnosis, gastric fever. Sarah collects $122. Bertha was 9. May the 26th, 1888, Willie dies. A different doctor this time. Same misdiagnosis, congestion of the bowels. Sarah collects $47 for a 2-year-old life. $47. Three members of one household, 67 days, approximately $349 total. And it was Willie, the last, the youngest, the smallest, who finally made someone ask the question nobody had been asking. It was Willie's death that cracked it open. Coroner Samuel H. Ashbridge, suspicious of three deaths in one household within 3 months, ordered an investigation. All three bodies were exhumed from Mechanics Cemetery. The evidence tells us what happened next. Professor Henry Leffman, a chemist, and Dr. Henry F. Formard, a pathologist, conducted the analysis. Large quantities of arsenic in all three bodies. The attending physicians had missed it every single time. This was a turning point for American forensic toxicology. Post-mortem chemical analysis proving what living doctors could not see. A drugstore clerk confirmed Sarah had purchased rough-on rats around the time John first fell ill. Sarah was arrested, placed on suicide watch. The confessions came in two rounds. The second was described as fully as revolting as the first. On Bertha, Sarah feared the girl would grow up sinful and wicked because a nine-year-old stole pennies. On Willie, he was in the way. Three words for the murder of a two-year-old. He was in the way. On John, Sarah claimed he took the poison on his own, out of despair at their poverty. She admitted she knew he was dying of poison and said nothing, because she needed the insurance money. November the 26th through 28th, 1888, 3 days, that's all it took. Sarah was charged only with Bertha's murder. One conviction was enough for a death sentence. The defence, two attorneys, Henry Paxson and George Arundel, they mounted an insanity defence. What followed changed the shape of the trial. Dr. Alice Bennett took the stand, the first female physician in charge of an American asylum at Norristown State Hospital. She testified that Sarah had low mental organisation and was undoubtedly insane. She proposed a theory of psychological insanity linked to reproductive and menstrual dysfunction. A woman doctor arguing that a woman defendant's mind was broken in a way only a woman doctor could understand. In 1888, the prosecution countered with Dr. Charles Miller, John Chapin, and Edward Brush, who agreed she was of weak mind but argued she was not legally insane. Sarah in the courtroom gnawing her fingernails, wiping her inflamed eyes, a woman visibly coming apart. The jury deliberated approximately 2 hours. They rejected the insanity defence. Guilty, first-degree murder, death. And here is the contrast that this entire episode has been building toward. Abraham Rothschild had 10 lawyers, a congressman, a future governor, and his family's fortune. He got 2 trials and an acquittal. Sarah Whiteling had 2 lawyers, 3 doctors nobody listened to, and an empty bank account. She got 3 days and a death sentence. Dr. Bennett campaigned for commutation after the trial. She failed. June the 25th, 1889, 10:07 in the morning. Wyoming Singh Prison, Philadelphia, approximately 30 witnesses. Sarah mounts the scaffold. Reverend William D. Jones delivers a short prayer. The trap falls less than a minute later. Sarah appeared calm at the end. She believed God would forgive her, believed she would be reunited with her children in heaven. She was the first woman executed in Philadelphia since colonial times. Sarah Jane Whiteling went to the gallows believing she would see her children again. Whatever else we say about her, she died believing she was a mother. But her story did not end on the scaffold. One doctor refused to let it.
Sarah Whiteling was buried. The records are sparse. She was a poor immigrant woman who murdered her family. The kind of person history forgets on purpose. Wyoming Singh Prison, where she was hanged, continued operating until 1963. It was demolished in 1968. Even the building is gone. Dr. Alice Bennett continued her work in psychiatry and women's health. Her testimony in the Whiteling case is studied today. A 2020 article in the Journal of the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law examined the case for its significance in forensic psychiatry and the gendered nature of criminal defenses. Bennett lost the argument, but she asked the right question. Is it possible that poverty and suffering and biology can break a person so completely that the usual rules of blame no longer apply? The forensic work of Professor Luffman and Dr. Formad, the chemist and the pathologist who found what the living doctors missed, became a reference point for toxicology in America. Willie's death, the last in the sequence, cracked the case open. In a grim way, the youngest victim was the one who finally spoke for all three of them. The Philadelphia Press called her the wholesale prisoner, a title that combined commercial language with horror, as if she was running some grotesque business. The truth is uglier and sadder than the label allows. She was a woman born in Germany, orphaned in infancy, raised by strangers, married to a man who died in prison, then married to a man who couldn't earn enough to feed the family. She lived in a back building apartment on Coldwater Street. She killed the people she was supposed to protect, and she did it for $399. And when the scales of justice weighed her fate, they did not hesitate. Two states, two killers, two scales. And here we are, almost 250 years into this American experiment, still asking the same question. In the 1870s and 1880s, America was building its story of equal justice under law. Courthouses were going up from Texas to Pennsylvania. Juries were being sworn. Judges were gaveling order. And all of it, every brick, every gavel, every word of every oath, meant something different depending on who you were and what you could afford. Annie Stone, called Diamond Bessie, a shoemaker's daughter who wore her worth on her fingers and was killed by a man whose family could buy a different outcome for every courtroom in Texas. John Whiteling, Bertha, and Willie, a factory worker, a 9-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old boy, poisoned in a back building apartment in Philadelphia by a mother who had been abandoned by every system that was supposed to catch her before she fell. We are almost 250 years into this experiment. The courthouses are newer. The laws are more refined. The forensics are better. But the question that Diamond Bessie and the Whiteling family force us to ask, does money change the outcome? Does poverty determine the sentence? Is the same question America has been asking since before it had a name. The jury in Marshall, Texas, drew a noose on the wall and called it justice. The jury in Philadelphia deliberated for 2 hours and called it the same thing. The question is not who was more guilty. It is why one of them walked free. Annie Stone deserved better. John and Bertha and Willie Whiteling deserved better. And if we're being honest with ourselves, 250 years later, we're still working on better. Until next time, good night, friend.